B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, May 18th, 2018. Six spineless, so-called Democratic senators paved the way for the torturer, Gina Haspel, to be confirmed as Trump's next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. It's a dark day for America and for what passes as the resistance. And the Democrats are so bad at being the minority party, playing defense, blocking the efforts of the majority party. It is really tragic to see it, and to see it play out with the kind of institutional amnesia required to forget about torture, forget about what the CIA did with its enhanced interrogation techniques, the rendition or kidnapping by corporate jet of certain people who were dispatched to countries where we knew they would be tortured, like Egypt and Syria. All that is washed away. And in the present tense, I want to name names here because Mark Warner, the top-ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, he's from Virginia, he should know better. We also have people like Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Joe Donnelly of Indiana, also Bill Nelson of Florida, that's Nelson, Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. And what these senators share is the spinelessness that comes from the fear of the Trump voter. Most of these are up for, I don't know about Warner, but I believe all the others are up for re-election this November. They're running in states where Trump either scored well or was declared the winner in 2016. And so their calculation is not about the blood stain on our nation's image. It's not about the acceptance, the rationalization of what is clearly immoral, illegal, unconstitutional, and un-American. No, it's about their own personal political survival. And they put that ahead of the interests of the nation and even their own political party. And let's be fair, three Republicans refused to vote for Gina Haspel, John McCain by not returning to Washington for the vote, and Senators Rand Paul and Jeff Flake, who both kept their word. Rand Paul doesn't always, but this time he did, and they voted against their president's nominee. And the bottom line here is that without the six Democrats, without even three of those Democrats, Gina Haspel's nomination would have failed. And so we've got to live with this. We don't know much about Gina Haspel. They allowed her to pick and choose what parts of her history were shared with the public, not much, and with the members of the Senate, just a wee bit more. Mitch McConnell rammed through the vote yesterday without any further debate. And it renders what passes for small d democracy in this country almost irrelevant. And I've got to remind you of one more thing here, and this will irritate some of my Democratic listeners. But Barack Obama set the stage for this to occur. First, by not prosecuting the Bush-era war criminals, including those who created the torture program and those who carried it out, like Gina Haspel and John Brennan. And because Brennan was a favorite of Obama's, and he passed him over for CIA director during the first term and then decided, well, it's cool, coast is clear, nobody's talking about torture, we're looking forward, not backward. Then he made Brennan head of the CIA ultimately. Those moves by Obama, in my opinion, created the climate for this to occur. And we'll, as Trump says, we'll see how it all turns out. I can't predict that it will turn out well. And while we're talking about the weak opposition by Democrats, New York Times has a story in Friday's paper about how the Republicans are busy packing the courts. While we're distracted by Russia, 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 and Stormy Daniels, and Michael Cohen, and Trump's tweets, 1/8 of the circuit court judges in America have been appointed by Trump and confirmed by this Republican Senate already. And there are more in the pipeline, and the Republicans are bulldozing some of the Senate rules that have stood for more than 100 years, namely, that if someone is appointed to a judgeship, the senator or senators from that state can use a blue slip to block that nomination. And they just bulldozed through that rule by confirming a judge from Wisconsin who had helped the Republicans just a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, block the confirmation for the very same judgeship because Obama had appointed a Democrat. And in the state of Oregon right now, both Senators Wyden and Merkley oppose the nomination of Ryan Bounds, a federal prosecutor in Oregon, because of racist and insensitive articles that he wrote while he was at Stanford University in his undergraduate years. And they say that other things since disqualify him as a federal court judge. But the Republicans don't care. And they will make sure that he is confirmed. Meanwhile, the distraction of the Trump-Russia narrative continues. And now it is Trump and Giuliani trying to figure out that one line that I read you yesterday from the New York Times opus about Crossfire Hurricane, the investigation into the Trump campaign, and the cryptic line about an FBI informant who had conversations with Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. And Trump smells a rat there or a mole, and he's busy looking for it. And so this gets a little complicated because, on the one hand, we have Rudy Giuliani today saying, well, you know, we've been told off the record that there was at least one informant for the FBI or Justice Department embedded in the Trump presidential campaign. But Giuliani admitted that he and Trump at this point don't know whether that's true. Quote from Rudy 9/11, first of all, I don't know for sure, nor does the president, if there really was one. We're told that. For a long time, we've been told that there was some kind of infiltration. At one time, the president thought it was a wiretap. Giuliani went on to say the president doesn't have proof. Now, this is pretty pathetic, because the president can declassify anything at any time. And the FBI is fighting to keep secret the name of this informant, even as Giuliani confuses things by saying, well, we're not really sure if there was one. So in today's Washington Post, an article with four bylines, Phil Rucker, Bob Costa, Carol Lenig, and Josh Dawsey, says that, over the FBI, for the past 2 weeks, they've been doing damage control to limit the damage if the source's identity is revealed. Now, the reason this is all so confusing is that it's all based on leaks. It's based on anonymous sources. The New York Times didn't identify how it knows that there was an FBI informant or maybe two in the Trump campaign. And so we are locked in this hall of mirrors where we are told things and credible media outlets tell us to believe them. But at this point, all I can report to you is what's being reported. So it does appear that there was at least one. The Washington Post goes so far to say that the source is a U.S. citizen who has provided information over the years to both the FBI and CIA and has aided the Russia investigation both before and after Mueller's appointment as special counsel a year ago. Trump's allies believe outing the source and revealing details about his or her work could help them challenge the investigation and possibly provide cause for removing Mueller or Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. So, based on this reporting, we are led to believe that there actually is such a person, that the FBI believes the identity of this individual is so sensitive that they don't want it released, could compromise other investigations, but hey, they throw up those smoke screens all the time. Their credibility is shot. And I'm in this awkward position because I've been a critic of the FBI for more than 40 years. And to be joined by Trump and his allies in attacking this agency for their partisan purposes, well, I can't defend the FBI. But that doesn't mean that I defend Trump or Giuliani or believe that they have anything other than opportunism and self-interest when they challenge the FBI and the Justice Department. I've linked to an article from Jacobin Mag, that's Jacobin Magazine, under the byline of Branko Marchetic. And Branko dug into the tranche of releases from the House Intelligence Committee last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, of the Russian Facebook ads. Now, brace yourselves, because I find all this very comical. The idea that Mueller indicted 13 Russians linked to the internet research factory there, the troll factory in St. Petersburg, is a joke. They will never face any American court, and that is simply a ruse on the part of Bob Mueller. Then, when you actually review the content of the ads that are blamed on the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, well, yes, they did use some divisive race-based messages. And you can argue that those would appeal to many people inclined to support Trump over Clinton. But a lot of the messages simply mirrored the kind of dialogue that's always going on in the United States about issues related to black self-esteem. Some of the ads read, "Black is beautiful, the black skin is a glorious symbol of national greatness, love your blackness, be proud of your skin color." Now, how does that drive people to take a certain political position? There were ads about Flint and the poisoning of the water system there. There are ads related to people like me who are opposed to wars and expansion of the Pentagon budget. Part of the campaign included promoting specific protests against racism. How would that have helped Trump? They shared stories of police brutality. There were messages of tolerance. There was a single ad that this writer found about Bernie Sanders. It was called Buff Bernie. It promoted a coloring book. And there were no pro-Sanders ads in the months of January, February, or May 2016. There was just one in March, the month of Super Tuesday. And the article concludes, "If the release of the thousands of the IRA's ads last week teaches anything, it's probably that the whole thing matters very little." Hey, get this! Sergei Skripal is alive and well and has left the hospital in Salisbury, England. He was declared dead by Bill Maher on his TV show about 5-6 weeks ago because, of course, he received a fatal dose of Novichok, the nerve agent that could only have been produced in Russian or former Soviet labs. That's all what we've been told by the British, embraced by the United States, used as the basis for new sanctions on Russia, the expulsion of diplomats by both sides. Pardon my language, it's a clusterfuck based on bullshit. And we are told that because of patient confidentiality, there will be no reports on the health of Sergei Skripal. But this is an international incident. There hasn't even been a decent briefing by a doctor on the status of Sergei and his daughter, Yulia. But today, we are told that they were placed into an induced coma shortly after the poisoning. Now, that's a reasonable medical procedure to try to preserve a human life. It could prevent poison from damaging organs that it hadn't reached. They were also given medication to suppress seizures and were told maybe an antidote. But this is crucial information. They were put into induced comas. Then Yulia suddenly woke up. Now, from what I understand, if you're in an induced coma, they just keep feeding you drugs to keep you under until they stop feeding you those drugs. So the doctors controlled when Sergei and his daughter Yulia emerged from the induced comas. We weren't told about those induced comas. We were told that they were sleeping as a result of the exposure to Novichok nerve agent on a doorknob. And, of course, they went to lunch. They traipsed around Salisbury for hours before the effects kicked in. And now we're told that maybe that was because of the substrate, essentially the carrier of the nerve agent. They said it could have been petroleum jelly or a hand lotion that was placed with the poison onto a doorknob. All of this is conjecture. And all of the information that I just cited is from the New York Times, which flatly states as fact the unproven elements of this far-fetched story. Let me read this, okay? Skripal and his daughter were both in critical condition after they were poisoned with a nerve agent known as Novichok, developed by Soviet scientists for battlefield use against Western troops. There's no alleged, reported, it's asserted, the British believe, none of that. This is yellow journalism, friends. That's where we are here in 2018. So Trump, with John Bolton whispering in his ear, has complicated things even further with the North and South Korea discussions and the potential June 12th meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. And Trump, trying to negotiate via the media, said, well, Kim's got two choices. Either he submits and denuclearizes like Libya did, in which case Trump offers him vague promises of security and stability. Or, well, these kinds of open-ended threats are really counterproductive in this situation. And the New York Times yesterday referred to the North Korean change of tune as a splash of cold water. But you got to understand, and I do, that Kim Jong-un is not to be trusted. He is a bluffer and a bully, and I think that he can outdo Trump in being unpredictable and in stomping his feet and changing the terms of negotiations. So I don't have great confidence in Kim Jong-un. At the same time, if his goal is to retain some nuclear weapons while reducing his threat to neighbors and the world in exchange for a reduction in the economic sanctions, that's a model along the lines of the deals that we worked out with the Soviet Union for nuclear restraint back in the 1980s and 90s. And so it does appear that Trump and Kim are on different wavelengths at this point. But to introduce talk of the Libyan model, knowing what happened to Muammar Gaddafi after he gave up his nuclear weapons, knowing what happened to Saddam Hussein after he stopped bluffing about nuclear weapons. Kim Jong-un is a lot of things, but I don't think he's stupid. And in the message that came from one of his underlings calling North Korea a nuclear weapon state, they were trying to distinguish themselves from Libya or Iraq and signaling that the North is seeking an arms control agreement, not disarmament. It's going to be a wild ride to whatever happens on June 12th. Meanwhile, Trump made a big blunder, I believe, by trying to use China to put pressure on North Korea and by linking his pressure on China to trade and the threats of tariffs and a trade war that have surfaced in subsequent months, Trump has boxed himself in. So China is now presenting a package of $200 billion in trade concessions, which everyone knows are largely illusory. This is to save face. These are press releases. And this, you know, might satisfy Trump. He clearly wants to, he at least has expressed the desire to reduce the trade war to some sort of an agreement with China even before the June 12th summit in Singapore. Now, I don't feel that that is achievable, but I consider myself rational and Trump not so much. Paul Krugman has done us a favor. Over the past week, I have been collecting information about Trump's move to try to save 75,000 jobs at the Chinese electronics company ZTE. He surprised everybody, including his base in coal country, by saying that, gosh, President Xi has asked him to intervene here, that our sanctions on this company, ZTE, are crippling to the point that it may go out of business. And so earlier this week, Trump just did a big about face and said, well, we're going to fix this in the interests of China. And the dots that Krugman connects include the other reports that have surfaced in the past week that China has agreed to invest about $500 million in a deal in Indonesia. This is money fronted by a Chinese state-owned company in a project in which the Trump Organization has a substantial stake. Now, this is so corrupt, just on the face of it, it should be disallowed. And this, to me, is another reason why Democrats should move to impeach Trump. There's plenty of information about his corruption, his corrupt intentions, and the flagrant violation of U.S. standards that he has practiced since he was named the president in November of 2016. And correctly, Paul Krugman also raises the issue I talked about yesterday, how the Trump administration joined the Saudis to put pressure on the nation of Qatar. Qatar refused a request from the Kushner family to refinance their building at 666 Fifth Avenue. Fast forward to 2018, the Trump administration is cozy with Qatar. Mike Pompeo, the new Secretary of State, has told the Saudis to stop ostracizing Qatar, and Qatar comes to the table to bail out the Kushner family on their bad property investment in New York. And I can understand the Republicans are silent. They're not going to unnecessarily criticize their president or take any kind of an ethical or moral stand. But where are the Democrats? Why is Paul Krugman the first to surface this as a substantive issue? Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the General Assembly conducted a vote, and it declared the American decision to move its embassy and to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital null and void. The vote was 128-9. 35 nations abstained under pressure from the United States. And while the vote is largely symbolic, it does, I think, speak volumes about the world attitudes toward Trump's move in that regard. Also, the state of South Carolina is about to become the first state to legally define criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. And I've been tracking these bills, an executive order in New York, a law in California. Many states have taken up this kind of legislation that abrogates my First Amendment right to criticize the nation of Israel and its policies by saying that any criticism of Israel is an attack on all Jews and is therefore anti-Semitic. And this new law in South Carolina offers an expansive new definition of anti-Semitism that is truly absurd. If you apply double standards by requiring Israel maintain a standard behavior that is not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, I mean, this is so arbitrary, it is so subjective, that if you call for, aid, or justify the killing or harming of Jews, making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews, accusing Jews as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing, who is the arbiter of these standards? Now, I completely deplore anti-Semitic expression of any kind. And in case you have any doubt, I do not hate Jews or Judaism. I am a critic of the policies of the extreme Zionist government of the State of Israel. And that is not anti-Semitic. And my decision to support boycott, divestment, and sanctions is completely covered by the First Amendment. We're waiting for federal courts to test some of these new laws, like the lawsuit brought by the teacher in Kansas. Meanwhile, the European Union is scorning Trump's move to exit the Iran nuclear deal. In a meeting in the European Union in Sofia, Bulgaria, the president of the EU said it would begin a legal process to prohibit companies based in the 28-member union from complying with the American sanctions. And down the road, we may end up being the rogue in this picture, where we're pushing other nations to embrace our sanctions regime against Iran, and they will not cooperate. And not only will they garner trade money from Iran, but it will weaken the American position. Our friend Gareth Porter, the historian and journalist who is often a guest on our podcast, he's got a new piece out that I've linked to in the show file for today's podcast, Bolton, Trump, and Iranian Regime Change, he says, Back to the Future. And he reveals the existence of a memo that John Bolton has been promoting, written by a murky group called the Security Studies Group. And this calls for regime change in Tehran. Now, Bolton has said publicly that he has those opinions, but in his new role as National Security Advisor, he doesn't make those decisions. But he certainly has Trump's ear, and Gareth Porter surmises that so far Trump has not picked up the call for regime change in Tehran promoted by John Bolton. It's worth reading the article. You'll find it linked at the show file here at peterbcollins.com. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Folks like Ethan Knox, Stuart Russell, Andrew Rush, and Mark Brodsky, just to name a few. I'm grateful for your support, and I need you. That means you with the earbuds listening to me right now as you're taking your daily walk. Make a note to kick in $5 or $10 a month to the Peter B. Collins podcast. All you have to do is drop by peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page, and you can take it from there. And as always, you can communicate with me by the U.S. Post. My mailbox is P.O. Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Good piece at Consortium News today about this Sunday's presidential election in Venezuela. And Roger D. Harris, who, I don't have his bio handy here, but he wrote this piece, and he is an expert on Venezuela and Central and South America. He recaps the history of American interference in Venezuela, and we are openly trying to destabilize the Maduro government. Now, I recognize that Maduro has become more of an authoritarian, but it's been in response to the U.S.-backed efforts to topple his government. I mean, the headline in Friday's New York Times about an opponent of Maduro uses the headline, Running with Confidence to Topple Venezuela's Dictator. Now, he's standing for re-election as part of a negotiated settlement with his opposition. That's not a full-on dictator. But the U.S. and our media characterize the Maduro government that way. And the real problem in Venezuela is easing because the price of crude oil on the spot market has rebounded, and that's what Venezuela desperately needs. 80% of its economy is based on the foreign exchange derived from oil. And this article exposes a memo written on February 23rd of this year called The Plan to Overthrow the Venezuelan Dictatorship, and it's called Masterstroke. Now, this was leaked on the website VoltaireNet.org, and I have not had a chance to review it myself. But this is a fairly damaging assertion. And, of course, it is consistent with the U.S. efforts to undermine the Venezuelan socialist governments since Hugo Chavez took power, and we openly were caught in an attempted coup back in 2002. Daniel Ortega was a darling of American leftists during the 1980s when he was part of the opposition in Nicaragua. And he's been in power for several years now. I can't remember when he became president. But right now he is presiding over a bloody crackdown. And it started with pensioners, and he kind of tried to sic his loyal students on the senior protesters, but the students have not cooperated, and they are now openly confronting the Sandinista Front. This has led to 65 people being killed, and from the accounts I'm seeing, mostly at the hands of government, police, and soldiers. Also, we learned that last week there were elections for the parliament in Iraq, and they didn't go the way the United States wanted. Muqtada al-Sadr, the anti-American cleric, who is he's spent a lot of time in Iran and is clearly aligned with the Iranians, he won big gains in the Iraqi parliament, which, of course, makes it more difficult for the U.S. to manipulate the puppet government there in Baghdad. I am at a loss for words, like most Americans, as we got the news this morning of another school shooting, this time in southeast Texas in the town of Santa Fe. The gunman survived, identified as 17-year-old Dimitrios Pagurtsis, and 10 of his fellow students are reported dead. The Trump administration is trying to revive the Reagan-era gag rule, and this is just an effort to pander to the religious extremists who remain loyal to Trump despite all of the exposure of his dalliances, if you will, and his just general moral bankruptness and inability to tell the truth. But because he is pro-life, they're all behind him. Now, ultimately, the Reagan policy was blocked by the courts and then quietly retired by President Bill Clinton in the early 1990s. And this may never go into effect, but it's another attack on Planned Parenthood, and it tries to, create the impression that contraception and abortion are equivalent and both evil. And that is a tragic, tragic mentality. Also, there's a group of rogue Republicans I mentioned yesterday, led by two California Republican congressmen from the Central Valley, David Valadao and, one other guy whose name is escaping me at the moment, Jeff Denham. And they have led the effort to get a discharge petition to bypass the Speaker of the House and bring the DACA bill to a floor vote in the House of Representatives. It's called a discharge petition, and they reach their goal. They have enough signatures of Republicans to join Democrats to push this over the line, and this could produce a benefit for the Dreamers and also a political setback for the hardline Trumpists in the House of Representatives. Also, the Freedom Caucus derailed a passage of an agriculture bill, the Farm Bill, over its concerns about immigration. And when Republicans are fighting, it's a good thing to stand back and watch. Finally today, Trump has made a promise that he probably won't keep. But Van Jones and a woman I know from here in California, Jessica Jackson Sloan, they have a nonprofit organization called Cut 50, and they are trying to reduce the federal prison population by 50%. It is a very worthy goal. And they are trying to work with Jared Kushner and the Trump administration to overcome the resistance of Jeff Sessions on the right and, oddly, Chuck Grassley, who is, at least on this issue, a little more to the left. So, Trump has said, bring me a bill, I'll sign it. The current proposal would release about 4,000 federal prisoners pronto. And it would make a few other minor changes related to compassionate release. But it doesn't address the underlying problem, the need for sentencing reform. So even if it passes the House, which it may do, with the help of Crown Prince Jared Kushner, well, in the Senate, Chuck Grassley says for any criminal justice reform proposal to win, it must include sentencing reform. So we'll see how this plays out, but it's a little bit of a bright spot in an otherwise bleak landscape as I peer out across America today. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.